Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Michael Nock, Dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley, and your moderator for today's program. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealth-club-.org. And now I'd like to introduce today's speaker, Dr. Imad Mustafa, Ambassador of Syria to the United States. Dr. Mustafa is a very distinguished student of computer science. He holds a PhD in computer science from the University of Surrey in England, and he's risen through the academic ranks in Syria at the University of Damascus, where he has been Dean of the Faculty of Information Technology at the university. He's also been Secretary General of the Arab School on Science and Technology, and is a co-founder of the Network of Syrian Scientists, Technologists, and Innovators Abroad, NASIA. He's been an active consultant to several international and regional organizations on science and technology policies in the Middle East, including UNESCO and several others. He's also been a member of the Syrian team responsible for drafting reform strategies for the Ministries of Culture, Education, and Higher Education. He's a versatile writer with a long list of publications in English and Arabic. He's published in a wide variety of Arabic publications and also in the Los Angeles Times and the Washington Post, among others, publishing more than 200 articles. I think especially noteworthy is he's the co-author of the UN-sponsored Human Development Report in the Arab World, originally published in 2003, which has been widely cited as a path-breaking publication, both an analytical and critical analysis of Arab progress and difficulties in achieving greater economic development. He's appeared widely on television in the U.S., Britain, Syria, and elsewhere, and he has also his own blog, Reflection of Modern Times, where he comments on culture, life, and friends in Washington, which is http://imad_mustafa.blogs.com. So he's very, very special, and this is actually his first diplomatic post, ambassador to Washington from Syria, a post he's held since March of 2004. So please welcome Ambassador Imad Mustafa.
Thank you, Dean Nacht, for your kind introduction, and I'm also very grateful for this wonderful opportunity to talk to people here in San Francisco and the Bay Area. So thank you to the Commonwealth Club of California. As Dean Nacht has noted, I'm not a career diplomat. Throughout my life, I was an academic. So when my government decided to send me here as the envoy of Syria to the United States, in a way or another, I was concerned, a bit worried. I went and consulted with a friend of mine who has been a distinguished diplomat from Syria, who has served for a long time as an ambassador, and prior to that as a junior diplomat. So I went and I asked him in apprehension of what will I be facing once I become the ambassador of Syria to the United States. He told me, it is so easy, you need to understand the difference between the ambassador and the camel. I told him, what do you mean? He said to me, you know, a camel can work for days and days without having any food. An ambassador, on the other hand, can eat for days and days without doing any work. And I loved it. And I came here, and what a big, big disappointment. Believe me, being the ambassador of Syria to the United States is not an easy job. It's an uphill battle. And the challenges are tremendous. The image of Syria here is a very negative image, and we do not have a friendly administration in the White House. So imagine how difficult it is for a small country like mine to not to be on the best list of the government of the most powerful nation on earth. Of course, this did not happen by choice. This is not what we want. This is not what we like. This is what we are trying to do, whatever we can within our capacity to reverse. We are trying to tell the U.S. administration, we have done this time and again, the last 5 years, that Syria is not an enemy to the United States, and it is contrary to our own national interests to be regarded as a hostile nation here in this country. But sometimes we feel like this is fatalistic and we can't do anything. So in a way or another, we have resigned ourselves to the fact that we just have to wait till the end of the second term of this administration before we can start a serious re-engagement with the United States of America. Let me be very clear about this. In the past, Syria and the United States had many disagreements and differences on a political level. But there was no enmity, no hostility. Actually, we do admire the United States of America for the great achievements America has done throughout its history, for the great things America has given to humanity in science, in technology, in the entertainment industry, and too many things. Yet, to be honest and candid with you, we in the Middle East, or at least this is our side of the story, we are so bitterly disappointed with U.S. policies in the Middle East. Rightly or wrongly, this is our perception. We believe that the United States of America has given flagrant, blind support to Israel while Israel was actually occupying our territories. And then, to add insult to injury, the United States decided to invade and occupy Iraq. And suddenly, a country like mine, Syria, became caught between the hammer and the hard place. One major conflict to our east, one major conflict to our south. The Arab-Israeli conflict that is still the cornerstone of all conflicts and troubles in the Middle East is still there, brewing nonstop, and another conflict has been introduced thanks to this administration in Iraq. As I have said in the past, despite the disagreements between Syria and the United States, we have always had a good, solid working relationship. This level of deterioration in relations between Syria and the United States is unprecedented in our modern history. Let me remind you of the fact that every American president, starting with Richard Nixon, ending with Bill Clinton, actually paid Damascus, our capital city, an official head of a state visit. In a way or another, this reflects the fact that while we were disagreeing with the United States, we kept on engaging with the United States for the benefits of Syria, of the United States, and for all other parties in the Middle East. Please do remember that the past two administrations that preceded the current administration, that of President Bush Sr. and that of President Clinton, worked so hard to broker peace between Syria and Israel. And twice we were on the verge of signing a peace agreement with Israel that would have had major impact on the whole situation in the Middle East. While we were very critical of U.S. policies towards the Middle East, we always believed that the only country in the world that can broker peace in our region was the United States of America, because of the influence and leverage the United States has on all parties, particularly on Israel. And this is why we always thought that while we can disagree, we should work with the United States and we should maintain the best possible working relationship with the United States. And we were successful in the past. I can give you just two examples before I move to the current conflicts in our region. Years ago, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, the United States invited us to join the alliance that drove Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. And our troops were next to your troops fighting against Saddam Hussein and pushing the Iraqi army out of Kuwait. This is so important for a simple reason. I hope you will think of it. When the United States asked us to join that alliance, the United States really did not need the Syrian military prowess to defeat Saddam Hussein and kick him out of Kuwait. It did this for a simple, different reason, out of wisdom, out of understanding that the United States did not want to present itself at that time as a Western crusader imposing its values or whatever it wants to impose, whether benign or malign, on the Middle East. This is why it went and invited two major Arab Islamic countries, Syria and Egypt, to join the alliance in liberating Kuwait. This is one example of past cooperation between Syria and the United States. Another important example that is rarely mentioned here in the United States has to do with September 11. After the tragic events of September 11, when every country in the world sent a condolences letter to the United States of America, Syria did something else. Of course, we did send a condolence letter to the United States, but we initiated contacts with America. And I underline the word initiated because we initiated this, and we told them, look, we in Syria, a secular country in the Middle East, have been fighting against extremist fundamentalists for the past 20 years. We are their own sworn enemies, and we have a wealth of information about those guys that we are more than willing to provide to the United States, not expecting anything in return, but because of our understanding of the dangers these groups represent to our own societies. What they did to you was horrible, was terrible, but it was, and forgive me for saying this, an isolated incident. While their threat to our societies and to our present-day existence is a fundamental threat. We provided the United States with information on Al-Qaeda, with intelligence that was described by a letter sent by Secretary Powell to the United States Congress as actionable information that has helped save American lives. That was the sort of cooperation we used to have with the United States prior to the war on Iraq. However, once we in Syria realized that the United States was adamant on invading and occupying Iraq, we became worried a lot. And we tried to discuss this with the United States because we were still on talking terms with the United States at that time. I remember personally being a member of a Syrian delegation that came to the United States and met with a high-ranking number of U.S. officials and tried to argue with them, to convince them not to go and invade Iraq. We told them, look, this is our region. We belong to that region. We understand exactly the nature of that region. Everything you are being told is absolutely false and untrue. There are no WMDs in Iraq. There is no relation whatsoever between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. Iraq is not anymore an imminent danger on any of its neighbors. I don't want to elaborate and tell you all the details we offered the U.S., but we were very clear in telling the U.S. that we believe that for you to go and invade Iraq, it would be equivalent to opening a Pandora's box of woes and evils. We said to the Americans, don't believe what the neocons are telling you. You will be met with rice, flowers, and ululations in the streets of Baghdad and other major Iraqi cities. Actually, if you go there, you would be unleashing forces. You really do not understand their true nature. We finally told them, look, our region is already troubled with too many wars and conflicts. We don't want yet another war, yet another major conflict in our region. Please don't do this. Of course, needless to say, they ridiculed all our arguments. They told us to the face. I remember very well, because this is a part of my personal history. I was there when they told us, you claim that you belong to that region and you understand very well your region. Well, let us tell you what will happen. Within 2 months of our, quote-unquote, liberation of Iraq, Iraq will become a model of prosperity and democracy that will inspire the whole Arab world. And believe us, every Arab nation in the Arab region will be dreaming of having the same fate as that of Iraq within 2 to 3 months of our liberation of Iraq. I don't want to go back to history. You exactly know what has happened to Iraq, what is happening in the Middle East today. Our relations have deteriorated dramatically after that with the United States. We became suddenly a rogue state, and now probably we are the most eligible nation to join officially the Axis of Evil list that has been compiled by this administration. I know this seems a little bit funny or sarcastic, but believe me, the United States is imposing sanctions and embargoes on Syria, and this is making our life very, very difficult. The whole life of the whole Syrian population, regardless of whether they sympathize with the government or they don't sympathize, whether they are responsible for Syria's opposition to the war on Iraq or they supported the U.S. grandiose project on nation reengineering, regardless, today Syria is paying a heavy price. And this is one aspect, but there are other aspects. Today in Syria, we have 1.6 million Iraqi refugees. This is an incredible burden on our infrastructure, our social services, our medical services, our schooling services. And for you to understand what does this mean, 1.6 million Iraqi refugees, you have to imagine 30 million refugees suddenly influxing into the United States. And you are a rich nation. We are not as bestowed by riches and fortunes as you are. And I am sure that if this happens here in the United States and suddenly within a very short period of time, you will end up with 30 million refugees, I think you can imagine what will happen in the United States. This is happening to Syria. Take our population in proportion into account, you will understand the meaning of having 1.6 million Iraqi refugees in Syria. This is a burden that Syria is troubled by, but it is just one aspect of the ongoing conflict in Iraq. There are other issues. All of them are very troubling and concern us a lot and are causing lots of problems for everyone in the Middle East. It's also the fear that Iraq might disintegrate and the repercussions this disintegration will have on the whole region. It might have a domino effect. Syria has a cultural, religious, ethnic, sectarian, linguistic mosaic that is far richer than the one in Iraq. Luckily, for the last 2,000 years, we lived harmoniously with each other. We never had any civil conflict or internal conflict in Syria. But we fear of what is happening in Iraq might have a spillover effect on the whole region. I don't want to tell you about the other things because really our problems are nothing compared to the tragedies and the agonies of the Iraqis themselves. I'm not trying to become cynical and try to tell you, look how much we are suffering in Syria, while our suffering is nothing compared to those of the Iraqis. Now, having said this about the problem of Iraqi refugees in Syria, please do remember that also we have 500,000 Palestinian refugees in Syria. Also, please do remember that last summer when Israel was bombarding Lebanon, we ended up with 625,000 Lebanese refugees into Syria. And also add to this the fact that today in Syria there are 125,000 Syrian refugees in Syria dreaming of the day they can go back to their towns, villages, and houses in the occupied Syrian Golan because they were forcibly expelled from the Golan when Israel occupied the Golan. This would only give you a glimpse about the sort of problems that a country like mine is facing in the Middle East, but it will also show you the sort of responsibility the United States has got towards the Middle East for a very simple reason. You decided to come uninvited to our region and to become our neighbor. You decided to provide Israel with full, absolute support for whatever Israel does, rightly or wrongly. I'm not criticizing Israel right now. I'm just telling you that by giving Israel this astronomical military and financial support, while Israel continues to occupy our territories, while the Palestinian nation has gone through incredible, incredible suffering and humiliation for the last decades, in a way or another, it is a decision taken by the United States to become implicated in the issues of the Middle East. In the last 5 minutes, before I stop, I want to go from the negative to the positive. I want to tell you that today there is hope in the Middle East, despite the bleak vision picture that I have just painted for you. At least I can tell you that all Arab countries, without a single exception, including my own country, Syria, have embraced the so-called Prince Abdullah Initiative that has become, after the Pan-Arab Summit meeting, the Pan-Arab Peace Initiative towards Israel. All Arab countries, without a single exception, are offering Israel, and they have done this publicly, on the record, and repeatedly, full peace, comprehensive peace, absolute normalization of relations, if they are willing to accept the fair principle of land for peace. If Israel is willing to give us back our occupied territories, the Syrian Golan, the Lebanese Shab'a Farms and Ghajar Village, and allow the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza to have their own independent, sovereign, viable state, just like every other nation in the world, the Israelis will get comprehensive peace and total security in return. And we think this is a fair and an honorable historic compromise between the Arabs and the Israelis. And in a way or another, even in Israel itself, there is a large constituency for peace that is supporting the Pan-Arab initiative. Sadly, the Israeli government has not yet accepted this Pan-Arab initiative. Having said this, we believe that peace between the Arabs and the Israelis is inevitable. There is no third option. Wars cannot continue forever between the Arabs and the Israelis, and they will lead to nowhere. The last war on Lebanon is a solid proof of what I am saying. And more Israelis today are realizing that they cannot continue forever to depend on their sheer military superiority and the absolute American support for their policies to impose on us the acceptance of their occupation, their policies of occupation. And they have seen last summer in Lebanon how that despite their sheer military superiority, they were incapable of securing their towns and villages. And in a way or another, more and more Israelis realized that the only way in which their grandchildren can live in peace with our grandchildren, in which they can be accepted by us as much as we might be accepted by them, is for them to relinquish their grand vision of expanding on our account, taking and grabbing more and more of our territories, driving more and more of our peoples outside their countries, their towns, their villages, their farms, and bringing more and more immigrants from elsewhere in the world into what they regard as the Jewish historic biblical promised land. This is why I am hopeful. The constituency for peace in Israel is today a minority, but it is a large minority. It's not a fringe minority. And it is growing steadily, slowly but steadily. And at one point, there will be a pivotal point after which the Israelis will realize, exactly as we have realized years ago, that the only path forward for us and for them is to reach a comprehensive, fair, and honorable peace agreement based on the principle of land for peace, as I have said. The United States bear a responsibility there, and it has fulfilled partially this responsibility in the past. The United States helped Egypt and Israel reach peace. It has helped Jordan and Israel reach peace. In the past, it brokered peace talks between the Palestinians and the Israelis and the Syrians and the Israelis. Today, unfortunately, it's the other way around. The Israelis have time and again sent us messages indirectly through indirect mediators telling us that they have no problem resuming peace talks with Syria had it not been for the fierce opposition of the White House. So look at this, how the U.S. policies have shifted from a time in which the U.S. was actually actively involved in trying to broker peace talks between the Syrians and the Israelis to a position in which they tell their Israeli friends and allies, literally, don't talk to the Syrians. I will stop by this small story. I met one of the prominent American Jewish leaders here in the United States, a Jewish community leader who truly believes in peace between Syria and Israel. And he was discussing with me possibilities to revive the peace talks between Syria and Israel. Then I arranged for him to go visit Damascus and meet with the Syrian president, hear from him personally if Syria was committed and sincerely desiring to make peace with Israel. Then he went and he met with the prime minister of Israel. The prime minister of Israel said to this leader of the American Jewish community, "We don't mind resuming peace talks with Syria. We have done this twice in the past. The problem is not with us. The problem is with your friends in Washington, D.C. They oppose doing this." In brief, this gentleman came back to Washington, D.C., and he met with a very senior official in the state, in the White House, who is in charge of the Arab-Israeli files and portfolio. I think you can know him without me mentioning his name. He told him, "How come that you are opposing peace talks between Syria and Israel?" The gentleman said to him, "Because we don't want to reward Syria for its bad behavior." And the Jewish community leader was outraged, and he said to him, "Can't you understand that peace between Syria and Israel is not a reward to Syria? It's a reward to Syria. It's also a reward to Israel. And most importantly, it's a reward to the United States." This is the mentality today in the White House. This is why there is a lot of talk, but it's much ado about nothing. Lots of talk about a peace conference that will take place in Annapolis late November. Most probably, this peace conference will lead to nowhere because, as far as we are concerned, nobody is discussing anything with us. There are no concept papers, no white papers, no memorandums of understanding, no intensive discussions prior to that meeting. Nothing, nothing. Which is so different in contrast to the Madrid Peace Conference that was convened by President Bush Sr. and Secretary Baker when they were in the White House. We remember very well in Syria the amount of intensive diplomatic negotiations that immediately preceded the Madrid Peace Conference. And we compare it to what's happening today. Absolute nothing. And in a way or another, forgive us if we deduce that this is only about a photo opportunity and about people in Washington, D.C. telling their electorate, "Look, don't accuse of us only of starting wars. Look, we are working for peace in the Middle East." But to be honest with you, we don't seriously believe that this is a peace conference that will lead to anywhere. I don't want to end my speech on negative terms. I have one funny story to tell you before I stop and start taking your questions. It has to do with President Bush himself and myself. When I presented my credentials to President Bush as the ambassador of Syria to the United States, I have to admit that he was a genuinely pleasant person and he did not try to make my meeting with him difficult. According to protocol, I asked my wife to accompany me during this meeting followed by a protocol celebration, a very small one, really. So President Bush met my wife, and he said to her, "Are you enjoying your life in Washington, D.C.?" She said to him, "No, Mr. President, right now I do not live in Washington, D.C. I'm pursuing my doctoral studies in England." And he was impressed. He said to her, "Wow, an Arab woman doing a PhD in England. In which field?" he said. She said to him, "In computer science." And he was genuinely flabbergasted. And he looked at her and he said, "Isn't that something?" He looked at me and he said to me, "Mr. Ambassador, your wife is both beautiful and intelligent." And then he said to me, "Ambassador, we both married up." I thought that was a nice compliment. But this is not the story. The story happened in the evening. In the evening, I was supposed to have dinner with my friends, and they knew that I was to meet with the president earlier in the day. So I went to the restaurant. My friends were waiting for me, and they asked me, how did your meeting with President Bush go? And I told them it went on very well, really. He actually flirted with my wife. And they said to me, "Well, thank God it was not President Clinton." Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Mustafa, Ambassador of Syria to the United States, for your comments this evening. We have a very large number of questions from the audience, far more than we can possibly accommodate, but let me try and select some from different areas. There appear to be three clusters of questions, a few on Syrian domestic issues, a few that link Syria's domestic issues with foreign policy issues, and then many, many on different foreign policy issues. So let me just one or two on the domestic side first. There's a question about why Syria's government under the new President Assad has not liberalized in the way some Americans had hoped for. And a very specific example of this is raised by one questioner. Let me just read the question. Why has the Syrian government sentenced human rights activists like the lawyer Anwar al-Buni to prison sentences of 5 years or more for working for greater political openness and minority rights in Syria?
You want an immediate response.
No. We could do it later, but...
What a starter. I think Dean Knecht is really selecting the difficult questions, but thank you nonetheless. I spoke yesterday at Berkeley. He was there. He introduced me. He moderated the speech, and I think he guessed what sort of questions I would be...
I'm just reading the questions.
Facing difficulties with. Let me be as candid as possible, but also as brief as possible, because we don't have lots of time. Of course, Syria is not an ideal place. I have to admit this. And you have also to remember that democracy is an unattainable ideal. Different nations progress and evolve towards a more democratic system throughout their history, including the United States itself. Remember your own history. You remember the slavery. Remember the civil rights movements. Remember some setbacks you had recently, like Patriot 1, Patriot 2, wiretapping, Guantanamo Bay. Nations go through major milestones. Sometimes it's a major movement forward. Sometimes you have setbacks. We are having right now setbacks in Syria. I cannot deny this. We had some major improvements, and they are there, and they are substantial in the past 5 years. But please do remember, we are a small nation, a small country, under extreme pressure that very few countries in the world can face and sustain. And yet, look at this most powerful of nations, probably the most powerful nation the history of mankind has known. You were attacked on September 11, and look how immediately the U.S. administration came out with draconian measures against your own civil liberties. I'm not justifying anything that we are doing. I'm just trying to remind you, please be realistic. And do understand that we live in a very, very difficult part, region in the world, with major forces struggling against each other there, from Islamic fundamentalism to the Israeli Zionist vision to American imperialism. Even if it is untrue, there is no American imperialism. America really only wants the goodwill of our region. But perception, as you know, is more important than reality, and lots of people have this flawed perception about American policies in our region. We have secular movements in our region. We have religious movements, fundamentalists. It's such a fraught region. Contentious issues are there, and you cannot easily say, as Dean Knecht has just said, we in America had certain expectations that President Assad did not meet in Syria. The only thing I can tell you is that the political situation and political opening in Syria today is far better than it used to be 5 years ago or 10 years ago, but it is still disappointing even to a person like me as a Syrian, as a human being. I would like to see more and more opening, political opening, more and more participation in the political process in Syria. Having said this, I do understand and realize how difficult the situation is in our region. Look at the Palestinians. Look, they went and they democratically elected their own government, regardless of whether you approve of it or not. That was their democratic choice. The very same day they elected the government of Hamas, the U.S. government imposed sanctions and punitive measures on the Palestinian people for democratically electing their own government. As if all the suffering of the Palestinian people was not enough, here comes the United States with more and more sanctions and penalties on the Palestinian people for the simple crime of democratically electing a government the United States does not approve of. Of course, you will tell me, no, it's not about approval. Hamas is a terrorist government, blah, blah, blah. You might be right. You might be wrong. Go and tell the Palestinian people, inform them. Tell them, look, next time, ask us before you elect a government. Be sure that we approve of it. It's such a complicated situation. I understand that my question has been very, very succinct, my answer, I mean, and I have not addressed the issues with all their complexities, but they are really complex issues. The only request we have is don't export your values and your wonderful, wonderful political system to other nations, because there is a risk that it might not fit in a very normal, smooth way. Be careful about exporting values to other nations. Be careful about nations re-engineering, because sometimes what the United States might think it was the pangs of a new birth of the Middle East, those might really not be pangs of a new birth. And I am quoting the expression used by Secretary Rice when she was describing the bombardment of Lebanon last summer. She said, those are the pangs of a new birth in the Middle East. For the Lebanese, those were not pangs of a new birth. They were only sounds of explosions of death and of destruction in Lebanon. Just be humble, modest, and careful. You want to give us things. There are wonderful things that you can give us in too many things. And if you don't want to give us anything, thank you very much, but don't export to us what we don't need. Let us evolve. Let us evolve. Let democracy evolve in our countries from within. It cannot be imported from without.
Okay. Here is a question that links domestic and international issues. Syria has its own Kurdish population. What is Syria's position on a potential Turkish invasion of Kurdistan in northern Iraq? Is Syria concerned that successful Kurdish attacks in Turkey could inspire similar Kurdish attacks in Syria?
That's an important question, and it also hints at the sort of problems the American liberation of Iraq has created. Of course, Syria has a large minority of Kurds, but almost everybody is a minority in Syria. The social mosaic in Syria is a versatile mosaic, and however we look across Syria, we find the Christian community, the Sunni community, the Alawite community, the Druze community, the Ismaili community, the Kurdish community, but they are all really one Syrian community. They don't live apart, and there is no tension between those communities. They cherish their cultural or religious heritage, but they consider themselves Syrian citizens. The same used to be the case in Iraq. People here tend to overview the fact that for the first time ever in the history of Iraq, Sunnis and Shiites are fighting each other. Here, people are saying, you know what, it's not our fault that our project in Iraq is not working. We went there to bring democracy and prosperity to the Iraqis, but those damned Iraqis are killing each other. You know why? Because Sunnis and Shiites cannot stand each other in the Islamic world. My challenge to any thoughtful American would be go and study the history of Iraq. Islam has been in Iraq for the past 1,400 years plus. And there has never, ever been, throughout those 1,400 years, a single civil war between the Sunnis and the Shiites. They have never, ever been involved in killing each other. They have always coexisted in Iraq. What a big, big surprise that only after the United States brings democracy and prosperity into Iraq, suddenly those Iraqis go berserk and start killing each other. Be careful about these things. Yes, today there is a major, major possibility that another conflict might erupt. You have just mentioned this. There is a possibility that Turkey would be fed up with the attacks by the Kurdish PKK party and the Turkish army will go deep into the Iraqi territories, where there is a majority of Kurds living in northern parts of Iraq. And this can be the start of yet another cycle. Today, there is no central state in Iraq. There is no powerful government that can say this is right or this is wrong in Iraq. Iraq has become really a no-man's land, or a land for anyone to interfere, thanks mainly to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And the situation there is open to all possibilities, and this is why we are so worried about this ongoing state of instability and insecurity in Iraq.
Okay. One final question, perhaps linking domestic and foreign matters. Does you state that Syria is one of the few secular countries in the Arab world? So how do you explain Syria's policies collaborating with the Iranian mullahs, who were deeply religious, and Hezbollah, also a deeply religious and militant Shia group?
Okay, the question is, how do you explain Syria's relation to Iran? And as you know, Iran is an Islamic republic. Of course, you always tend to forget that another dear neighborly nation to us is Saudi Arabia, which is also an Islamic kingdom. But let me go back to this question. It is so important, and it creates lots of misunderstanding here in the United States of America. Yes, Iran is a friendly country to Syria, and we have excellent relations with Iran. Don't frown upon this statement. Don't start saying, what is this? We thought that was a decent gentleman. Please do remember, Israel is occupying today, while I speak, a part of Syria. And we are officially in a state of war with Israel. So Israel is our enemy. Yet Syria is offering Israel peace. We are telling the Israelis, give us back our occupied territories and let us live in peace with each other. Let us normalize relations. No. Iran has never done anything to Syria in its history, nor to anybody else. Iran is not occupying the Palestinian territories. Iran is not occupying the Golan. Iran is not occupying Iraq. Iran did not bombard Lebanon last summer. And yet here we are always frowned upon because we have good relations with Iran. It's true, we have good relations with Iran. Please do remember, Iran is not an Arabic country. It's an Islamic country, just like the United States is a Christian country. Mainly Christian country, and Russia is a mainly Christian country. But you are not Russians, they are not Americans. We are Arabs, they are Persians. We don't even have the same language, but we share the same religion. The issue is the following. Why shouldn't we have the best possible relations with our regional neighbors if they have not done anything bad to us? Now, you would say, we in America, we hate Iran, we think Iran is a rogue state, okay. I don't want to go into this. It's your privilege. If you like to make friendships and enemies across the world, it's your privilege. You are a world superpower. You want to have problems with other countries in the world, your privilege. We are a small country. We are already troubled with too many conflicts in our region. Why should we be hostile to a country that has never, ever done anything to us, anything bad to us? Today, our number one trade partner, our closest ally in the world, happens to be, guess which country? It's Turkey. Turkey is Syria's number one trade partner. Our second largest trade partner in the world, surprise, surprise, is the European Union. Our third largest trade partner is Iran. Why not? I understand that you hate the Iranian government. Okay, it's your privilege. They haven't done anything to us. If they would do something to us, we might reconsider our positions to Iran. But we are always flabbergasted by the fact that the United States expect us to be hostile to Iran because you are hostile to Iran. Be fair towards us, please. Thank you.
There are several questions commenting on your comments about the forthcoming Israeli-Palestinian peace talks in Annapolis, Maryland. One questioner writes that David Brooks of the New York Times has described the formation of an anti-Syrian, anti-Iranian, anti-Hezbollah bloc by Secretary of State Rice for those who participate in the conference. Will Syria, in fact, attend the Annapolis conference? If not, what would it take for Syria to attend?
We don't know if we will attend or not. We told everybody that up till now we have not been invited. So how can we decide to come if we are not invited? Now, there are rumors in Washington, D.C., and you know Washington is a city laden with rumors, that we will actually be invited 2 or 3 days prior to the convening of the conference, so that we will be put in the awkward position of saying, okay, we will not attend, and the United States will say, ha-ha, we caught the Syrians. They keep on claiming that they want to make peace. We invite them to a peace conference. They don't come. These are rumors. We really don't know. We might not be invited at all. But also... Also, these rumors say so that Syria would be put in such an awkward position. If they accept the invitation and they come, we have to tell them in advance that the Golan will never be discussed. And this is the part that really, really concerns us, a part of Syria that is occupied. Can you imagine any country in the world, forget about Syria, going to attend a peace conference in which the other side is attending on one condition, that we never discuss the issues between them and us? This is preposterous, but this is exactly what the U.S. administration has said. They have said, we plan to invite Syria. They have not invited us yet, but this is what they said. And there will be no discussion whatsoever on the Golan. This is what the American officials have said. And we are supposed to just come, attend, listen, be bemused, enjoy our time, and leave. Personally, if my government will ask me my opinion, I would say it will be a waste of money buying those expensive airline tickets and reservations in hotels just to come and attend this event in Maryland and then go back to Syria, when they are telling us as clearly and as explicitly as possible the Syrian issues cannot be discussed in that peace conference. You just come, attend, and leave. Now, I thought that this was because Syria is regarded as a rogue state. This is why they don't tell us anything, and we only depend on rumors. But last week, I met with my friend, the Palestinian representative in Washington, D.C., the Palestinian ambassador, Afif Safieh, and he told me the following story. He told me that he requested a meeting with the assistant secretary of state, and he went and he was telling him, complaining to him, isn't that something? We, the Palestinians, are the major party in this forthcoming peace conference, and we don't know anything about this peace conference. It was through the Israeli media that we read that the peace conference will take place in Annapolis. It was through the Israeli media that we, meaning the Palestinians, read that the peace conference will be postponed from early November to late November. You never tell us anything. You only tell us that you will be invited to a peace conference. But we are feeling, in a way or another, awkward. We don't know anything about this peace conference. And the gentleman from the U.S. administration said to him, take it easy. Don't be very upset about this. It's not like we are giving all the information to the Israelis and hiding it from the Palestinians. It's just that we are thinking loudly in front of them, and they have this system, they leak everything to the press. So don't be offended. There is something that is really not serious about this peace conference. Anyhow, when we will be invited, we will tell you if we will attend or not.
Okay, here's a question of a little different type. In his recent controversial book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, former President Carter stated that the Bush White House had denied President Carter's request to visit Syria in 2005 to meet with President Assad in order to isolate Syria by prohibiting visits by prominent Americans. What are the current limitations, to your knowledge, on travel by ordinary Americans who might wish to visit Syria?
There are no limitations whatsoever for any American citizen to visit Syria. Obtaining a Syrian visa to go and visit Syria is very easy. It's a one-hour process. There are not even U.S. legal constraints against U.S. citizens visiting Syria. It's not illegal for you to visit Syria. The Syrian embassy and the 3 Syrian consulates in California, Michigan, and Texas offer an average of 100 visas per day to U.S. citizens planning to visit Syria. What President Carter has said has to do with politics. At one point, he called the Syrian embassy and he said that he wants to go and visit the Middle East, meet with their leaders, hear from them, try to get a better understanding about the situation in the Middle East. We immediately welcomed President Carter, regardless of how you look at him here. I don't want to go into domestic policies. We respect him in our part of the world. And we respect also President Clinton. And We definitely respect President Bush Sr., so it's not partisan. So so we told him, of course, you are welcome, and it was an appointment between him and President Assad was set and everything. And suddenly, out of the blue, a senior official from the National Security Council calls President Carter and says to him, please don't go to Syria, don't meet with the Syrian president. This is so bad for America. And President Carter insisted. He said, there is no law against me visiting Syria, and I believe that even talking to even to the enemy is good for the United States. So there is no explanation whatsoever for your request not to visit Syria. According to President Carter, then the then National Security Advisor, Ms. Rice, called him and she said to him, President Bush personally asks you not to go to Syria. And if you will go to Syria, it will undermine his position. And I don't want to make it a lengthy story, but for reasons only known to him, he decided to cancel his trip. A year later, something similar happened. The Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, decided to visit Syria. And I met with her, and we started to arrange for this visit, and the White House heard of this, and they did everything possible to prevent her from visiting Syria, but she would not listen. She went there 4 months ago. She met with President Assad. She had a large congressional delegation with her. I was there at the meeting, and I think this was a very, very serious engagement. She told us, look, we think that we have problems with you on those issues, and we understand that you have problems with us on those issues, but we believe that when we have problems with another nation, it is most importantly that we engage with that nation, we talk to that nation. That is why diplomacy was invented. It's not only to talk to your friends, it's also to talk to those you disagree with. And we believe that that was a very successful visit, and in a way or another, the congressional delegation that accompanied Speaker Pelosi, many of them are chairmen of committees in the Congress, believed that that was a very important and fruitful visit, regardless of the issues. The level of engagement was very serious. When she came back, President Bush made it very clear to her that he was very upset because she visited Syria. And her reply to him was, Mr. President, we are the world superpower. If we have an issue with a country, we talk to that country. And he said to her, we are sending messages to the Syrians through intermediaries, other European nations. And she said to him, but why would we in America need another country, a third country, to go and talk to a country like Syria? If we have an issue with Syria, we can talk and discuss this issue with Syria. It serves our national interests and that of the region. And in a way or another, it explains to you the school of thought, the school of diplomacy that this administration adopts or believes in. The people is divided into the good guys and the bad guys, black and white, rogue states and benign states. We only talk to good states. We don't talk to the bad guys. Unfortunately, Syria has been put in the black box of this administration. And in a way or another, they cannot understand the need to engage with us, despite the fact that we are telling them nonstop and in every possible opportunity that we want to re-engage with the United States. We are not an enemy to the United States. This is bizarre. They have decided that we are their enemies. Well, we don't believe that we are your enemies. And we want to find a solution to... We already have lots of common ground, and we have some other contentious issues, and we are willing to address them.
There are several questions exploring the differences between the Syrian position vis-a-vis Israel and Egypt's and Jordan's position. When Egypt and Jordan reached peace with Israel, they received back occupied territory of their own that Israel had held. Are you saying in the Syrian position, not only must the Golan Heights be returned by Israel, but also Shaba Farms, which is a Lebanese-Israeli issue, must be returned, and the Palestinians must have a nation of their own, which is a Palestinian-Israeli issue, not a Syrian issue. Why are you linking Palestinian issues and Lebanese issues to a Syrian-Israeli peace treaty?
No, sir. I did not say that Syria puts conditions on making peace. It's not us that are putting conditions. But also, I'm referring to the fact that Israel there in this region has occupied parts of Egypt, Jordan, Palestinian territories, Lebanese territories, and Syrian territories. And Israel had some visionary, courageous leaders that made peace with the Jordanians and the Israelis based on the principle of land for peace. Then the late Prime Minister of Israel had the courage and the vision to start peace talks with Syria. And a peace agreement was almost formulated between Syria and Israel based on the line of June 4, 1967, and on recognition, mutual recognition of both states, diplomatic exchanges, normalization of relations, everything, but including giving us back our occupied Golan. To make it as succinct as possible, Yitzhak Rabin was tragically assassinated. Then other prime ministers of Israel came who do not believe in the historic compromise between the Israelis and the Arabs. They believe that God has given them this victory, not the U.S. military technology, it's God, so that they can occupy these territories. And by winning this territory through war, this territory becomes theirs. This is their ideology. I'm not saying that we don't have also extremists in our part of the world. But unfortunately, those are the new leaders of Israel. So until Israel gets another visionary leader who is willing to make this compromise, the situation will continue to be stalled and stagnant. Having said this, I didn't say that we will not sign a peace agreement with Israel as long as the Palestinians are under occupation. But what I have said, and this is so important for everyone to think of and to realize, is the following. If Israel really wants to be accepted in the region, not just sign a peace agreement. Look, Israel has a peace agreement with Egypt. But the Egyptians, the overwhelming majority of the Egyptian people, are sympathizing with the daily suffering of the Palestinian people. And they were outraged by what Israel has done to Lebanon last summer. What I'm trying to say is, it's for Israel, not for us. If it's for Israel, if they really want to live in peace with us, all of us, and to be accepted, I said if they want their grandchildren to live in peace with our grandchildren, they have to realize that they need to treat their neighbors with respect and forget about the hubris of power. Israel is a very powerful country. Thanks mainly to the United States, but it is a very powerful country, and it believes that since it is that powerful, it does not need to make any compromises with its Arab neighbors. And I mentioned the remaining three major crises between the Israelis and the Arabs. So our situation is exactly similar to that of Jordan and Egypt. What has changed in Israel, not in our side of the equation.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, where our guest is Dr. Imad Mustafa, Ambassador of Syria to the United States, who is discussing his country's view of the U.S. and the prospects for peace in the Middle East. Several questions about the recent Israeli attack on an alleged nuclear facility in Syria. Could you comment on it?
Okay. This is an extraordinary story that really needs to be discussed.
And by the way, some of the questioners wanted to know about the seemingly rapid cleanup of the site, which seemed to hinder international judgments about what was really going on there.
Well, there are two different stories, so let us compartmentalize. One story has to do with the actual raid that took place a couple of months ago on Syria. Three Israeli jet fighters penetrated deep into the Syrian airspace and bombarded a military target in Syria. By the way, those three jet fighters were U.S. made. What I'm trying to tell you is this has happened. Nobody is denying this. Syria was the country to announce it. We were the first to announce it to the world. Israel has penetrated, unprovoked, our airspace and bombarded a Syrian military target. Israel itself, go and verify this, never claimed that those were nuclear installations. For a simple reason, they know, and the Bush administration exactly know, that there are no nuclear installations in Syria. Syria has never attempted in the past to acquire nuclear technology. It is not attempting right now to acquire nuclear technology, and we do not plan to acquire nuclear technology in the foreseeable future. We have seen what has happened to Iraq, despite the fact that Iraq never had WMDs. We do not plan to allow our enemies, and they are formidable enemies, to use such a pretext to bring freedom, democracy, and prosperity to Syria in a way similar to what has happened to Iraq. So the story is absolutely, absolutely untrue. What happened in that raid? They attacked a military installation in Syria. This is not the first time Israel does this. And it might not be the last time. It's one incident in a very long series of military minor and major clashes between Syria and Israel. 2 years ago, they also attacked a Palestinian camp in Syria. And it might happen again. I'm not belittling this incident. It is damaging. It is very damaging to the peace prospects between Syria and Israel. But theoretically speaking, it's so easy to take place. You have to remember the ceasefire line between Israel and Syria is only 30 miles away from Damascus, the capital city of Syria. It's so easy for any Israeli jet fighter at any given moment to penetrate the Syrian airspace. And the same applies to us. It's so easy for any Syrian missile at any given moment to attack any Israeli city. But I don't think we plan to do this. And probably the Israelis deliberately chose, probably because we cannot understand exactly what they were thinking of, deliberately chose a military target of very minor significance so that it will not provoke a new war between Syria and Israel. Of course, it has done a lot of damage to other issues, but this is not the discussion. Now, let us, as I said, compartmentalize, forget about what has happened between Syria and Israel. It will enter the history of the Syrian-Israeli conflict as a minor footnote. The extraordinary thing happened here in the United States, and this is really something. Suddenly, every other day in the Washington Post and the New York Times, you would read a story about the North Korean-Syrian nuclear cooperation in Syria and how Syria is building nuclear facilities in the Syrian territories and how Israel conducted this preemptive strike to prevent Syria from building a nuclear bomb. Every other day you will have such a story. Of course, the Washington Post and the New York Times will try to give themselves the appearance of being objective and careful. So after printing this whole story of the Syrian nuclear project, they will always add some qualifiers by the very end, quoting some experts who would say, really, there is no proof whatsoever about any nuclear technology in Syria. Nobody has ever heard before that Syria has nuclear technology. And this target can be any target. It's just a building, just a building. And all the photos, it's such a silly hype. All the photos, they were available on Google Earth and on other commercially available satellite-taken images, are photos of a building, nothing else. Not even a building that resembles that of a nuclear reactor. And most importantly, only a week ago, the New York Times published a story saying that those photos of this building have been captured first in 2003 by a commercial U.S. satellite service. So suddenly, 4 years later, Israel and the United States wake up and say, wow, this is a Syrian nuclear facility. Let us go and attack it. I wrote a letter to the editor of the New York Times, and it was not published, telling the New York Times, isn't that something? You are being Judith Millard for the second time within 5 years? You have published all those silly stories about the Iraqi WMDs, and you never learned your lesson? Don't you think about the reputation of such an establishment like the New York Times? And that's it. You just take those stories from the White House, and you just publish them like this without even trying to corroborate those stories. In short, because I know we are running out of time, there is definitely and absolutely no nuclear project in Syria. We understand that we do not live in a fair world. We understand that the United States has double standards. And we know very well, we are realists, that if Syria will attempt to acquire nuclear technology, then the gates of hell will open on Syria. We have seen what has happened to Iraq. Thank you very much.
We are not quite done yet. Ambassador,
I have the hammer. Can I use it?
Not on me, I hope.
No.
Ambassador Mustafa, it is at the point, though, unfortunately, where we are close to out of time. So we have one last question, and that question is, Do you believe that anyone in the audience here tonight or anyone listening to the broadcast will live to see a true comprehensive peace between Israel and the Arab world?
As a human being, as a person, as a Syrian who lived all his life in Syria, yes, I do believe that peace will eventually prevail in the Middle East. Look, it's a historic inevitability. It will happen. There is no other alternative. Israel cannot continue forever to depend on its sheer military superiority to continue to occupy our territories. The Palestinian nation deserve their independent sovereign state, and eventually they will get it. And believe me, this will happen. Deep in my heart, I know that it will happen. And one day you will read in the news that an independent sovereign Palestinian state was established and recognized by the world community. And probably, hopefully, peace was signed between Syria and Israel, Lebanon and Israel, the rest of the Arab world and Israel. In a way or another, yes, I do believe it will happen. What really saddens me is the fact that till this happened, people will lose their lives, more and more suffering will be imposed on those under occupation, innocents will be killed on both sides of the conflict, regardless of which nationality or which faith they adhere to. They are, after all, human beings, and every single loss of a single human life is a loss to all of us, regardless of whether they are Jewish or Muslims or Christians. They are human beings. This conflict will, at one point, terminate. The big question is when and how. And the how is easy. At least we have tried this time and again between the Arabs and the Israelis, and it has worked. As far as we are concerned, we already have a draft peace agreement between Syria and Israel. It's just the misfortune that Rabin was assassinated, that this agreement never materialized into a fully blown peace treaty. The other question is the when, and I think as a person, I am an optimist. I believe it will happen, not in the lifetime of your grandchildren, but in your lifetime. In your lifetime.
Our thanks to Dr. Imad Mustafa, Ambassador of Syria to the United States, for his comments this evening. We thank our audiences here and on the radio. I am Dean Michael Nacht of the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Mr. Ambassador, please come back. Thank you for a wonderful program.
Thank you. It was a great.